afternoon, Your Honor. Please report. I'd like to reserve the student's time, if I may, Your Honor. Your Honors, for 122 years, from 1881 to the commencement of this action, the Mohawk Preserve had an unbroken, unchallenged chain of title to this state property. That property was first challenged when Mohawk Preserve brought an action to quiet title under the RPAPL and was met with counterclaims. The answer to those counterclaims consists of about two pages. Counterclaims, to my read, seemed to be thrown in there, and they simply said, "Well, we have superior title to your claim, Mohawk Preserve, and if we don't have that, we have we own the property by adverse possession." And that launched an odyssey that took almost 10 years to resolve, beyond the 10-year mark now with the appeal, in which the court below found that the defendants in this case had a superior title based on a 1/6 undivided, unplottable interest in a 92-acre parcel. They claim devolved down to them from a deed that goes back to 1841 and another deed in 1855. It was never specifically mentioned again after 1862. They claim that undivided 1/6 interest in a 92-acre parcel survived the next ensuing, well over a century, through deeding clauses, general artifact clauses in a deed that conveyed the interest of the prior owner, whatever it may have been, regardless of whether it was specifically delineated or not. They made this argument, that's their argument for both a superior claim of title to Mohawk Preserve's claim. It also forms the basis for one half of their adverse possession argument, which is that they own the property by virtue of a colorable claim of title to. There are so many infirmities with the claim of superior title, but I'd like to start with one that I think is critical, and it's procedural. In their counterclaim, the defendants had the burden of proving to a preponderance of the evidence that they had superior title. They made no real or honest effort to meet that burden. Instead, they attacked Mohawk Preserve's title. Not from 1881 forward, of course, because their own experts conceded that Mohawk Preserve's claim and title was valid from 1881 on, an unbroken chain. They admit that. They sought to attack the 1881 deed itself, the 1881 deed that followed the 1879 tax sale. Notwithstanding statute of limitations that prevented them from making that challenge, notwithstanding the wholesale lack of proof, of course, hooking off with proof 122 years after the event, and that's the purpose I would submit why this state and why the legislature passed the statute of limitations that governed legal challenges to tax deeds. But they tried to raise irregularities with the tax deed. They called it a redemption without proof. They indicated that it was not served properly without proof, that the tax arrearage. And then they used an assemblage of deeds from the 19th century, where every witness in the case and the judge acknowledged in the trial below that record keeping in the 19th century was anything but precise. But they pull a little bit out of this deed and a little bit out of that deed, and they say, "Oh, gee, this adjoiner's a little different, and this property boundary might be over here, and this might have been severed off, or might not have been, and this might have been sold or might have been retained." Somehow, some way, that leads to a conclusion in their mind that the property description in the 1881 tax deed was somehow not precise enough. Notwithstanding that that property description was precise enough that for 122 years, the owners of that parcel in unbroken chain were able to identify it specifically, were able to pay taxes on it, were able to mark it, and were able to have it referenced in 9 separate instruments. We placed in the record, the trial attorneys placed in the record, 9 separate instances, 9 separate instruments, where the boundaries established in the 1881 tax deed were carried forward, including
two. If we get back to that tax deed, and I hope you can clear something up.
Be my best, Your Honor.
It appears that Judge Cahill says that you got a King Flame lot in that back deed, 26 acres. And as I recall the machinations here, Moses, the Pugh's kids got the lot, the southern 92 acres of lot 101. And that eventually, according to Scratch's client, moved into the Walches, which ends up as the southern adjoiner to the King's Lane lot. And the 26 acres in that particular lot goes back to the tax assessment rolls of 1876. Now, when I look at it, that page 2193 looks like it says 96, not 26. Is there, are we stuck with Judge Cahill's conclusion that that was a 26 acre King's Lane lot?
Well, no, Your Honor. First of all, this court, in a bench trial setting, is entitled to make a full sweeping review of the record and sit de novo and review the evidence in total. And I don't even think that that is really a critical issue. There were references to a 96-acre plot and a 92-acre plot continuously throughout the paper.
That reference to the 96, was that the same reference that Judge Cahill indicates as 26?
Judge, yes, I believe that that was described at the trial as a typo, that the 96, that should be 26 or vice versa. Well, that's where this came from.
But did Judge Cahill accept the proof that it was 26?
Well, Judge, I think that the record as a whole and the totality of the record demonstrates that it was, in fact, a 92-acre parcel, and that that was what was conveyed by way of the Coddington deed in 1881. And so we have this deed coming down. The challenge is based on the 19th century deeds, things that came before, are refuted by the doctrines of practical location and the practical effect that the Coddington deed was given, not only by the predecessor owners.
There's no acreage in the Coddington deed, as I recall, is there?
I don't believe so, Jeff. There's a description, and of course that description is alleged to be infirm, but under the doctrine of reasonable specificity, it reasonably identified the property for the next 122 years, including by surveyors commissioned by the defendants. The defendants not only commissioned surveys and a correction deed, they filed them. They filed them in 1988 and 1995. Without challenge to the boundaries that the Mohonk Reserve contends to this day establish the parameters of the property.
Say those dates again.
1988 and 1995 were the dates of the surveys that were commissioned by the defendants. One of them accompanied a correction deed, and they were filed, proving Mohonk Reserve's case, if you will, by, I think, admission. But certainly by the doctrine of practical effect.
Well, because the practical location argument raised by the respondents sounded like a really good one to me. They were saying that on your side you had not sort of closed it and it followed a high ridge road. I'm looking for my notes on it, but there was that their surveyor, or the survey that they had, followed the high ridge road and so sort of came to a logical conclusion. And yours didn't. I think I've got that.
Well, in one instance, Your Honor, there was issues of monumentation and different calls, but we have a superior level of proof than that in the form of our deed instruments. And we had practical location was, their surveyor, the same surveyor who went out in 1995, walks the property and sees that Mohonk Preserve, which had purchased the property the year prior, had freshly marked the boundary line, and he made a notation of that, and he acknowledged that in his testimony. So there's a lot of Johnny-come-lately arguments now attacking this 1881 deed and its progeny down through the years, but we established the superior claim of title with our undisputed evidence. They rely on 1841, 1855, 19th century snippets drawn from different instruments, document here, document there. This adjoiner is wrong. All our deed had to do was establish with reasonable certainty where the property was located. And then we have the problem, unaddressed in the brief for the respondents, how does an undivided, unplottable one-sixth interest in a 92-acre parcel, and there the 92 was undisputed, which is 15 acres by division, how does that possibly lead to a conclusion that they should be granted title in fee to a 93-plus acre, or a 73-plus acre parcel? It defies my understanding, and it's not addressed by the respondents because I think there is absolutely no answer to it. They were unable to identify their parcel with the specificity required by the RPAPL. And once they added that affirmative defense to their answer, they had that affirmative burden. What they did instead, what they continue to do on this appeal, is take hot shots at our title and think if they throw enough darts at the wall, they throw enough mud, that they then will be the default owners of the property.
Interrupted, moving into your 2 minutes.
All right, I will defer. Thank you, Your Honor.
I've responded to defenders.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I would like to reserve 1 minute for
Do we have a...
There's no prosecutor.
There's no prosecutor. So we're not entitled to the one. We're involved. So you're on your own here
well,
for the next 10 minutes.
And
I'll take 73 acres out of an undivided 1/6 interest.
Well, let's start with the plaintiff, the appellant's title. The appellants have really mischaracterized the respondent's argument on their title. There's no question that the 1881 tax deed, a joiner description, is a spot-on description for a 26-acre parcel located on the northwest side of Rock Hill Ridge. It's an adjoiner description. And what appellant is doing here, and what they try to do with the trial court, is they completely disregarded the fact that the adjoiners identified and find them to that side of the ridge. And they said, well, we've got an acreage call, so let's go to some parole evidence. I'm going to start with the adjoiners in the 1881 tax deed. The testimony and the proof of trial is that that tax assessment and then the deed got on the assessment roll because in 1874, Osterhout conveyed to Coddington, the ultimate tax sale purchaser. And when he gave the deed to Coddington, he said, we're giving you a 4-acre parcel, which is way up in the north end of Lot 1. And he described that 4-acre parcel was bounded on the east by John Davis. And he described right-of-way physically located that run to and through that parcel through the lands of John Davis. And then Osterhout gave another parcel, which he did not state in verse 4. He said this parcel is also bounded east by John Davis, south by Huck and Chase, west by Keeter and Shealy, north by Coddington on the lands outside of Rockland to the north. Okay, John Davis looked everywhere in the appellant's brief. Not once do they mention or address the trial court's determination that John Davis is only located on the northwest side of the ridge. This court has twice already resolved that issue in prior litigation involving the 1200 Circuit. The deed into John Davis, 1851, says, I'm bounded on my northeast and southeast by Jacob Ruza. Jacob Ruza, as the trial court determined and informed by all the deeds in the chain of title, was the easterly adjoiner to the 73-acre dispute in this case. Chase, south by Chase. In 1873, less than a year before Osterhout sells the land to Coddington, William Chase acquires the 1/6 undivided part of Lot 1. That deed gets recorded. A year later, Osterhout, and prior to this time, as we established a trial and stressed in the briefs, prior to 1873, William Chase never owned anything in Lot 1, didn't own anything in the vicinity. In 1873, he gets an interest in Lot 1, and get some land further to the east, down in Lot 4. That year, Osterhout, who recites in his deed, I live on this property, my southerly adjoiner is William Chase. It's not a coincidence, that's parole evidence.
Chase got an undivided 1/6 interest.
That's right. As the court pointed out during Mr. Rupp's presentation, originally, 1818, I believe, Will of John Depew leaves 1/6 to each of the 6 grandchildren of Moses Depew. What occurred next? There was a conveyance of the lands on the north side of the ridge that became referred to as the Curran Farm, which bisected lots 1 and 2. the records, the deeds in the evidence in the chain of title show that Osterhout emerged as a hostile exception to that current farm. What our surveyors and title experts testified to at trial is there was no basis because of the current farm and hostile claims by Osterhout to, we obtained a 1/6 undivided part, therefore we 1/6 own of the entire 92. However, our surveyors and title experts testified at trial that because of the hostile claim of Osterhout out of the current deed, there was no basis after 1941 and certainly after 1947 to extend the interest of William Chase any further north. They had been cut off by Alger, Curran, and then Osterhout. So how did we get 73 acres? It's everything that was part of the undivided part of those 92 acres that lay to the south or east of Rock Hill Ridge. That's how we get that acreage. It is an undivided part. It's not 1/6%. They weren't subdivided below the ridge. Now,
well, it was my recollection, and please, it's 1,500 pages, got me busy, that your expert witnesses, your land surveyors, said they couldn't plot the 1/6.
No,
there's no way they could. They didn't have enough.
There was a.
So how do you specifically describe 73 acres?
The reference in the record to the statement attributed to Robert Cross Jr., who is not a surveyor, is not a licensed surveyor, he made the statement that Mr. Ruff has quoted. Robert Cross Sr. is our surveyor. He was our licensed land surveyor, as was Robert James. They testified that through the use of the deed, specifically saying the land is located within a finite area, it's within lot one of the 19 Parker's tract, and then being able to determine with certainty, based on the deed descriptions, the division line created by the current farm chain of title that began in 1841 and carried forward. And then, also, all the deeds in the Apollo's chain of title from 1874 to 1976, which all fall for William Chase as the subdivision. So that is how they were able to ascertain it. And the case law, as far as sufficiency of description, says, if a description can be located, even if it has to be done by survey, or if there's confusion and you need to bring in parole evidence, the description is sufficient if it can be made sufficient through any source of parole evidence. And in this case, the parole evidence, one of the strongest pieces, is the appellant's chain of title that acknowledges us as their southern boundary. A tax deed can convey property, but it cannot convey that which was not included in the underlying fee that gave rise to the assessment. Now, I've spoken briefly about the John Davis parcel. Terry Carl, the appellant's title witness at trial, acknowledged my location of John Davis as is attached to appellant's brief as one of the addendum. There's two maps by demonstrative exhibits by Terry Carl. It wasn't presenting them as a survey. But the first one had was supposedly a depiction of the 1881 tax deed lands. Now back then, the appellants would claim that 1881 tax deed included about 92 acres. And so Mr. Carl depicted the entire 92 acre parcel, which was almost all of lot one of the 19 Parker's tract. And he depicted John Davis as the adjoiner on the southeast side of Rock Hill Ridge. That was wrong, and he acknowledged, I have been overruled by the courts as to the location of John Davis. And gladly went forward and said, but I'm still placing him here. And when presented with the fact that, well, the Osterhout deed, which you acknowledge, describes the same land as the tax sale, specifically says that John Davis bounds very up in the northern end of lot one, this 4-acre parcel, and everybody agrees that John Davis is not on both sides of Rock Hill Ridge. How do you address that? No answer. Could not address the fact that all of the rights of way, one of which is King's Lane, and the appellants came in at the trial level saying, we know we have the King's Lane lot because King's Lane runs through it. And they were unable to prove that, and we proved through ancient documents, which are presumptively correct, that King's Lane ran through lands of John Davis on the northwest side of Rock Hill Ridge. The survey, Richard Brooks, in his testimony, said yes, the eastern bounds of John Davis is the ridge. It's on the north side of the ridge. they can't be both places. So we're now accused of saying the tax deed is insufficient. No, it's insufficient to describe a 92-acre parcel that goes down to the southernmost bound of Lot 1. It doesn't do that. If you want that deed to describe those lands, you have to get into parole evidence, and you have to explain why Ruza is not the correct boundary. You have to explain why Du Bois Coddington is not identified as the adjoining on the northeast side. You have to explain why the rights of way all referred to in the deed that gave rise to the assessment are not present. You have to explain what court rate is on the southwest side of Lot 1. None of this can be done. So the appellant's first argument.
Well, my simplifying matters if I say it could be explained simply by saying that the 1876 tax assessment roll, which describes King's Lane Lot, mm-hmm. is actually 96 acres.
That
your map would put the King's Lane Lot in the northern part of that lot. The 96 acres would take the whole of Lot 101, wouldn't it?
If King's Lane Lot was 92 acres, the problem with that is that the tax deed, by its definition, says I have to be bounded on the south by William Chase, and you cannot use parole evidence to change a boundary call. You can use parole evidence if there's ambiguity, but not to change a boundary call, and this court noted that in Anderson versus Mesa. Regarding practical location, I don't know how you can even raise that argument that there's acquiescence when you look at the possession, the adverse possession that has been going on since the 1960s and 70s. Title to that property had ripened into the respondent's predecessor, Wilbur Smith, by 1987. But as Justice Carey pointed out, the 1988 map by Gerald Grant was of lands on the northwest side of the ridge. It did not depict the bounds of Lot 1. It did not depict the bounds of Gloria Finger, appellant's predecessor. It depicted a portion of the line that Mr. Fink testified at trial when he saw that line extending, following the ridge. It confirmed his understanding based on decades of use, first as a patron and then as an owner, and statements of his predecessor that the boundary line of the western portion of the Smitty Grant holding continues across that ridge line and then comes down to the road, almost the road in that portion.
I've used your time, but I'll give you a minute to wrap up your argument.
Thank you very much. Going forward, all that the appellant received, okay, because the appellant got a deed from Gloria Finger, and that Gloria Finger deed conveyed 73 acres. It did not convey the land acquired in the text. I think the record said it said, we're giving you these 73 acres, they're south of this line. So Gloria Finger actually retained the King's Lane lot. The appellant got nothing. In the meantime, our chain of title, although admittedly at points becomes very oblique, survived. It was never conveyed out of our chain, and consistent with that, from the 60s forward, we don't have witnesses alive that can speak to earlier, but from the 1960s forward, it was occupied continuously. It was law. There was a hunting club with paid members that stood out from the local population. It was a gathering place for free spirits in the hippie era. Hiking, camping, taking stone for sale and for use in the construction of the other buildings on the property. Taking firewood for use by the occupant to heat their home. Selling firewood, logging, hiking. Everything that you can think of that can be done on property of that nature wasn't just done seasonally, it wasn't done sporadically, it was constant, and during this entire time, where was Gloria Finger? And then, from 1994 forward, where was the Mohawk Preserve? They got the deed in May 1994, they commenced the action just shy of 10 years in February of 2004. Where were they that entire time? To take a map and a correction deed that arose from a different litigation over neighboring properties with a different litigant, which reflects this is a map of the lands in dispute in this case, doesn't show all the remaining lands on the west side of the road, on the east side of the road. That's an improper use of that map. It doesn't stand for what the appellant is intending to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, please, the board. I hear again and again that under this 1881D, based on these references to 19th century instruments, that we have to explain this and we have to explain that. We have to show exactly this and find this adjoiner and find this boundary line. The law of the state of New York says otherwise. It says that all our deed needs to do is identify this property with reasonable certainty. And that deed did so, and it did so for 122 years. The trial court found not that our deed did not sufficiently describe the property. The trial court found that it was a redemption, which, as we briefed in our principal brief, is clearly wrong. An owner of property can purchase a tax deed providing a fee simple absolute in the property, even though that owner may have waived the right of redemption. The only proof, other than conjecture and speculation, the only proof before the court is that this was indeed a purchase, a legitimate purchase by Coddington of the tax deed of the property via the tax foreclosure process in 1879, filed that deed in 1881. The adverse possession arguments that they make, I'll simply say this. When they do not have colorable claim under a written instrument, they are entitled, even if they were able to establish that any of these sporadic, non-specific, vaguely described events from the numerous witnesses that they prayed before the court arise to the level of adverse possession, they're entitled only to the portion of the property that they actually possess. And they never identified it. It was like, oh, over that ridge, or over there behind that, or down in this valley. They never identified any specific property, so there's no adverse possession here. And to claim that evidence arises to clear and convincing evidence, I think is crazy. I will leave with this. Their own expert, under their title claim, and claim survives from 1841. Their own expert, a man of many, many years in the business, said that he had never, ever seen somebody try to establish a chain of title through 147 years of being clauses with no specific references to the property in 147 years. He'd never seen it done. I submit that this court should not allow it to happen, and that the reversal of the underlying decision is important.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you both. Please call the next case.
Yes, Your Honor.